Today, we're all looking for ways to save. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in, then flags any hidden errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see any other healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Before we start the show, just a reminder to share, like, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And please, give us a 5-star rating. It helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Also, if you love Red Pilled America, please consider supporting the show. You can buy one of our 100% Made in America products. We have hats, candles, a book. That's right, we wrote a book. Or you can become a Backstage subscriber. Well, you'll have access to our entire archive, and you can hear the behind the scenes of each episode, along with Patrick and I arguing over who's a better storyteller. Or you can just make a donation. To support the show, please visit redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away. Thanks, everyone.
Previously on Red Pilled America.
You know who hates me the most? The transgender community.
A certain segment within the alphabet movement didn't appreciate Dave's jokes.
I don't want to write these jokes, but I just can't stop.
Chappelle's comments about the transgender and LGBTQ plus communities have outraged many who are now calling for the special to be removed.
Tonight, Netflix employees walking out of the company's Hollywood office.
What the public had just witnessed was a new type of conflict. It was actually a battle between two algorithms.
Netflix has a really specialized platform, and they track their customers really closely.
Are algorithms controlling American lives? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
We're at part two of our series of episodes entitled The Algorithms. If you haven't heard part one, stop and go back and listen from the beginning. We're looking for the answer to the question, are algorithms controlling American lives? By telling the story of the clash between two algorithms. One made by Netflix, and the other crafted by perhaps the most powerful company in the world. So to pick up where we left off, Mark Randolph and Reed Hastings wanted to bring the movie rental experience online. On April 14, 1998, the two launched Netflix, an internet DVD rental by mail business. They were told that it would never work, and in the early days, it looked like the naysayers were right. It took the company a year and a half to land on a business model that worked, a combination of no late fees and renting DVDs through a subscription service. But the thing that actually drew people back was a recommendation algorithm that suggested films that Netflix thought a particular customer would like. Their algorithm was even better than Amazon's because Netflix was almost exclusively capturing the personal likes and preferences of their customers, where at Amazon, a gift for Aunt May could make it into the mix. Now at launch, Reed Hastings played more of an investor's role, while Mark Randolph ran the company. But as the year 2000 approached, Netflix needed to raise money.
You know, Reed was not active full-time. I mean, he was my chairman, he was my angel investor, but he was going to school, and I was running the company, starting and running the company.
That's Netflix co-founder Mark Randolph.
But, you know, he was involved, and it was great to have his sounding board, and we talked all the time. And so it wasn't unusual for him to stop in to the office on his way home in the evening. And he stopped in one night and, you know, knocks and basically says, "Mark, we've got to talk." Reed was concerned. He was concerned about the business. And more specifically, he was concerned about my judgment. And these weren't necessarily big things he was seeing, but he was seeing patterns that he was concerned that as the company got bigger, as we moved faster, would become problems.
And Netflix was going to have to start moving fast because it was burning through cash at an alarming rate. The company needed to raise money. The problem was that tech investors liked a certain kind of credentials at the top of the company, the kind of credentials Mark Randolph lacked, but Reed Hastings possessed. Reed had sold his previous tech company a few years earlier for what was at the time the biggest Silicon Valley sale in history. So to raise money and get the company out of the red, Reed believed that he was better suited to be Netflix CEO.
I thought he was firing me. He had more stock than I did. But what I learned as we talked some more was he was saying something very different. He was really saying that this company would be stronger if we ran it together. And he was proposing that he'd join the company full time, that he'd come in as CEO, that I'd move over as president, and we'd do it together. And it was a hard ego moment. And I can't say that I just went, okay, this was hard. You know, there was a lot of wine drunk on the porch with my wife as we kind of worked through this. But fundamentally, I realized, you know, Reed was right, that it was almost inarguable. The company would be stronger with the two of us doing it together.
So Reed took over as CEO, Mark became president, and the two got to work. They had no time to waste because the industry was on fire. The mid to late 1990s was the gold rush era of e-commerce.
We're on track, it looks like, to hit a billion shares today.
Internet stocks drove a powerful surge on Wall Street today.
Some say the internet is so revolutionary that the usual rules for valuing a stock, such as revenues and earnings, no longer apply.
Priceline.com is the latest beneficiary of the internet stock craze. Shares of the internet commerce company debuted at $16. They closed at $69, a rise of over 330%.
Earth Web was up 379%, and the Globe.com, which only traded one day, gained 606% on the week.
The Amazon.com of drugstores went public today in the latest smashing net debut. Drugstore.com nearly tripled in price.
As late as April 2000, Wall Street money was practically being given away to e-commerce websites. Again, Mark Randolph.
Back in April, you could go out on Highway 17 over here and put a sign up for the flag, and the truck would pull over and then dump all the money into your driveway.
From 1990 to mid-2000, nearly 5,000 new companies went public. Netflix wanted to get in on the action, and by the beginning of the new millennium, the company started preparing for an initial public offering, or IPO. But then,
it's described as nothing short of breathtaking, a points drop never before seen on the US markets. This closing bell might as well have been an alarm, so savage was the selling.
The dot-com bubble had burst.
It was enough to force the Dow Jones down 616 points, a drop of 5.5%. The fragile technology stocks even harder hit, the NASDAQ index in freefall down nearly 10%. It lost a quarter of its value in just 1 week.
Netflix arrived at the party too late, and now the company was in trouble.
So we're screwed. No way to raise money. We're hemorrhaging cash.
The company had found a solid business model, and their algorithm was the magnet that kept customers coming back for more. But the crash was a drag on the entire e-commerce universe, and it made every dot-com look like a dot-con. investors saw them as too risky. Their free money completely dried up, so Reed and Mark had to pull their plans for going public. They had to come up with a new strategy to stay alive.
That year, we were going to close the year with about $5 million in revenue, but we were going to lose about $50 million getting there. So not sustainable, not without some miracle.
They needed to sell the company and fast. So they decided to turn to their brick-and-mortar competitor, Blockbuster, for a lifeline.
Now, this was going to be a bit of a tricky proposition. In late 2000, comparing Netflix to Blockbuster was like measuring a mouse against a woolly mammoth. Netflix was on track to pull in $5 million a year in revenue. For Blockbuster, it was $6 billion. Netflix had a few hundred employees. Blockbuster had 60,000 employees. Blockbuster had 9,000 stores. Netflix had zilch. Again, Mark Randolph.
And so we called them for a meeting, nothing. We had our VCs do the go-between, nothing. Silence. And then we go about our business, go, okay, I guess we're going to have to get out of this some other way. And we were at a corporate retreat. We were in Santa Barbara in the foothills in a little resort called Alisal Ranch. And it's pretty casual, and there's horseback riding and all the usual BS you do in a corporate retreat. And I had packed pretty lightly. I had t-shirts and shorts and flip-flops, and that was it. And that, of course, is when Blockbuster calls and says, we'll see you. We have an opening tomorrow morning. And we're going, how are we going to get from here to Dallas by tomorrow morning?
They decided to splurge and chartered a private jet.
So we fly to Blockbuster, fly to Dallas, go up to their huge skyscraper, up to the 37th floor, wherever it was, in this huge conference room. And it's me and Reed Hastings and our CFO, Barry McCarthy. And I'm in shorts and a t-shirt. And Barry has on a Hawaiian shirt. So I'm jealous that he has buttons. And the Blockbuster guys come in their fancy clothes and the fancy expensive shoes and the whole thing.
Blockbuster CEO John Antioco walked in as well.
And it was this symbolic representation of how out of our league we were. And we make the pitch, we'll combine forces and we'll find the synergies that we will run the online part of the business, they'll run the stores, we'll do a blended model and we'll promote it in the stores. It's a win-win for everybody. And it was going great. They were nodding their head and they're asking good questions. And then they asked the big question, which is how much should we pay for you? So we figured that was going to come up.
Since they were $50 million in the hole, they decided that would be the number.
So $50 million.
But when they hit Antioca with the $50 million price tag, Mark noticed that the Blockbuster CEO took on a different demeanor.
He had this expression on his face and I couldn't quite read it. And what I eventually realized is that he was trying to hold in laughter.
In reality, it wasn't an outlandish offer given their revenue. But with the dead bodies of other e-commerce businesses still stinking up Wall Street, the CEO of Blockbuster thought the offer was preposterous.
And he was watching all these companies. He's looking at the Webvan, Cosmo.com, all of them crashing and burning. No apparent viable economic model for .com. If you had a .com, it was the scarlet mark on you. We flew home. Disappointed would be the understatement. We were desperate. We didn't know where else we were going to go. We're flying back going, oh man, not only do we not have Blockbuster saving us, now we're going to have to compete with them. And it was extremely sobering.
But what Mark and Reed didn't know was that a historic shift was underway. And they were about to be the right company in the right place at the right time.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code. A lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Do you want to hear Red Pilled America stories ad-free? Then become a Backstage subscriber. Just log on to redpilledamerica.com and click join in the top menu.
Backstage subscribers also get ad-free access to our brand new video podcast called Fam Boogie. Fam Boogie is the place where we help you bypass the entertainment gatekeepers. We talk about pop culture, woke Hollywood, drama in the media, and great movies, TV shows, and podcasts, all as we guide you towards content that the Hollywood gatekeepers try to bury. Go to redpilledamerica.com right now and click join in the top menu.
Join today and help us save America one story at a time. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. I'm Adriana Cortez. In 2001, Netflix was in dire financial straits. They had landed on a business model that was generating revenue, but they'd burnt through too much cash to get there. They were $50 million in the hole. To look for a lifeline, co-founders Mark Randolph and Reed Hastings went to Dallas, Texas to pitch the Goliath blockbuster on purchasing the company for $50 million. The CEO of the retail movie rental giant practically laughed them out of their office. The two went home dejected and desperate. They had no idea how they were going to save the company. But despite their predicament, Netflix was onto something. When they pitched Blockbuster in 2000, they were on track to pull in roughly $5 million a year. By 2002, revenue grew to a whopping $21 million in just one quarter. And what caused this enormous upswing? The answer, DVD players. In 2001, an astonishing 127 million DVD players were sold. Consumer spending was surging for this new technology, and Netflix was there to reap the rewards. Even as other e-commerce sites were dying, Wall Street took notice of Netflix's stunning growth.
Most of the people who are involved in the IPO market now still have some very deep battle scars as it relates to anything.com.
Netflix has found success in its business by renting DVDs to a growing group of subscribers.
In mid-2002, the company decided it was time to reapproach Wall Street.
Netflix made a spectacular debut on the NASDAQ stock market today. The online DVD rental company priced 5.5 million shares at 15 bucks a pop.
Netflix Incorporated went public at an $82.5 million valuation.
By the end of the initial public offering, Reed Hastings was firmly in charge of Netflix and had become the public face of the company.
An IPO is like high school graduation. It's big at the time, but with hindsight, it's only really a beginning of something else.
Mark Randolph left the company the following year. Reed Hastings took hold of the reins from there, and people were gunning for him because the Dallas bigwigs that laughed him out of their office just 3 years earlier now saw Netflix as a real threat. In 2004, Blockbuster launched a Netflix copycat site.
But with Blockbuster Total Access, you can do something you can't do with Netflix. Exchange your movies for new ones right in the store, no extra charge, just in case you need them. Movies through the mail, plus movies through the store, one low price. That's Blockbuster Total Access. Get a free trial at your Blockbuster store or Blockbuster.com.
It was game on. But in the eyes of Reed Hastings, it was too little too late.
Blockbuster didn't start competing against us until 2004, so 5 years after launch, okay? So that was too long to wait. However, once you wait that long, it may well be better not to enter, because by that time, you know, we had a couple hundred million in revenue, we had a big balance sheet, we were, you know, going to be really hard to profitably dislodge.
Netflix had a serious head start. For over 5 years, their recommendation algorithm was getting better and better. It was giving them a competitive edge. Few understood that advantage, but their success started making people curious. Journalists began to wonder how they were doing it.
I was the beat reporter at Reuters in Los Angeles, and I covered entertainment companies. And I covered the entire entertainment vertical. So that meant studios to distribution companies to movie theaters.
That's Gina Keating, author of Netflixed, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs. In 2002, Gina began noticing the small DVD rental outfit.
And then I had this little company, Netflix, which had about 500,000 subscribers, and they were mainly on the coasts. And I couldn't really figure out how it worked, because back in those days, they shipped DVDs in the mail. They had a pretty rudimentary website, and I couldn't figure out why we were covering this company, because there were other alternatives that the studios were trying to do, like download boxes and things like that. So that's how I found out about them. And in the next 8 years, at every juncture where they had to make a decision about where the entertainment industry was going, they were right and the studios were wrong. And it was just remarkable to me. And if you remember, you know, we had a recession, a huge recession at that time. And every time that Netflix was faced with some kind of an economic downturn, they seemed to get stronger, because they correctly predicted that people were going to want to consume entertainment in their homes, and that the trend towards entertainment was getting more individual. So that I wanted to explore how they did that.
She came to the conclusion that in large part, it was their user interface that fed their algorithm.
They made sure that that user interface was loaded with ways to watch the people who went on that site.
By 2005, a year after Blockbuster launched their Netflix copycat service, Netflix was raking in $688 million a year in revenue. And it was largely because their six-year-old algorithm was predicting a demand in forgotten films.
Netflix had people on that site browsing and pretty much telling them about their lives. And they were really able to catch a lot of trends that the studios didn't see coming.
By 2006, the media started catching on to this competitive advantage.
But what are these stars? Those stars are the
key to the system.
Okay.
They show what other people that have my movie taste think of this movie.
That's part of their recommendation system. So let's say you rent On the Waterfront.
I could have been a contender.
And give it 5 stars. Netflix software searches for what other On the Waterfront renters have rated highly, figures out from other movies you've rated whether it's Brando you like, films in black and white, or mob flicks, and voila.
I'm going to make them an offer again with you.
They offer you other movies. Hastings thinks the recommendations have transformed the movie business by giving new life to thousands of forgotten or overlooked films.
We need to help one another.
Like Hotel Rwanda.
I cannot leave these people to die.
I did very little theatrical business, but our members like it a lot. They rated it very highly. So our website promotes it to more and more people. And now Hotel Rwanda is the number 5 all-time rented film at Netflix, which is above Wedding Crashers, which is a great mainstream film.
As Netflix exploited its algorithm, others were looking to get in on the action.
We started last October with 5 shows.
That's Steve Jobs at a 2006 Apple conference.
Only 5 shows. And we've been adding them since. We now have over 220 TV shows. Customers have purchased and downloaded over 45 million TV shows. There is one more thing. And that is movies. We are making available over 75 films online starting today. We're going to be adding more every week and every month. Movies are going to be available on the iTunes store the same day as they are released on DVD.
Netflix was facing the juggernaut of all juggernauts. But Apple's entry didn't seem to worry Netflix CEO Reed Hastings.
Netflix itself will be a movie downloader, says Hastings, who claims he'll be able to beat the big dot-coms like Apple that have announced they're getting into the game too.
More successful than Apple with the iPod and all of that?
More successful than Apple, Yahoo, Amazon, absolutely. Because those companies, they focus on a lot of things, you know, books and music. We think that we can be the winning firm by focusing on movies.
But the future was anything but certain. Netflix was a DVD rental by mail service. Apple was on its way to revolutionizing the way movies and TV shows could be purchased and rented. It was anyone's game to win. But Netflix was about to choose a subtly but profoundly different path forward. Netflix saw subscription-based streaming as the future. In early 2007, Netflix launched this new service. Initially, they didn't have much in their library, only around 1,000 titles out of the more than 70,000 that were available on DVD. And that's because Hollywood studios didn't want to play ball. Since the birth of file-sharing sites like Napster, Hollywood had been resisting the digital era. Again, Gina Keating.
They were terrified. You know, they didn't like the idea of digital media because it was so easily copyable.
So the Hollywood studios were only willing to license bottom-shelf titles to Netflix. Titles they didn't value as much as their big tentpole films and hit TV shows. But Netflix took what they could get, and they used their algorithm to see a gap in the market that Hollywood studios couldn't see.
Like the desire for old television. They couldn't get great content because nobody wanted to sell it to them, and there wasn't even a digital right at first. So they actually had to go in and say, okay, give us the worst stuff that you have and we'll take it. But they were able to get a lot of niche content, which was international movies, anime, Bollywood, you know, stuff that people in middle America, you know, maybe didn't even know about, right? But a lot of it was great content. And so they had to design an algorithm that would put people out of their comfort zone. You know what I mean? Like, if you liked Steel Magnolias, maybe you'll like the Steel Magnolias of Italy. So you're broadening your horizon. It's really kind of great because, you know, you never knew that you might like this, but the algorithm was that good that people had a lot of satisfaction being turned outward away from the things that they would normally pick that were in their comfort zone. And Netflix had to do this because they had to make these kind of tenuous connections to get people to come back.
And Netflix found other unexpected behavior.
Then they realized that, oh my gosh, everybody wants to watch the entire catalog of Gilligan's Island. Who would have thought that? Who would have thought they'd sit down for a whole weekend and watch a catalog of an old television show? But they figured that out and they kept it secret, and then they started buying stuff.
They were able to keep it secret for a while, gobbling up forgotten TV shows and films at bargain prices. But once they'd begun pioneering subscription streaming content, Netflix entered a new kind of deal-making arena. You see, when they were just a DVD rental business, their model was simple. Reed Hastings.
Everybody's got every DVD. Blockbuster and us had the same content offering because it's non-exclusive licensing to get DVDs.
Generally speaking, Netflix was just buying movie DVDs and renting them out. But now that they were streaming, Netflix was more beholden to Hollywood studios because the studios could withhold the streaming licenses. The film studios held all the cards because Netflix wasn't making the content. Gina Keating.
But they didn't have any experts in Los Angeles and New York everybody was in Silicon Valley. So you had this idea of how do we gather the biggest audience that we possibly can and sell to them? And they had the gather it and the algorithm down, but they couldn't make content, so they really needed Hollywood.
But Hollywood didn't need Netflix. That is, until 2008.
The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm, filed for bankruptcy.
As the 2008 financial crisis hit, Americans began to tighten their wallets. The nighttime ritual of dinner and a movie shifted to eating takeout in front of your home entertainment system, and film studios were feeling the pinch.
In 2008, 2009, 2010, all of them are publicly traded, right? So, and they're all considered value stocks. So they had to make their numbers. And the way that they were trying to make their numbers when people couldn't go to the theme parks and they couldn't buy stuff was to sell rights, to sell off rights to their content. So they were selling off their rights to Netflix to try to make their earnings numbers so that their stock wouldn't crash.
And it was no longer just old second shelf content.
They sold off a lot of really good stuff to Netflix catalog to help Netflix grow.
Films like Spider-Man 3 and parts of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise began streaming on Netflix.
During the downturn, when people had no money and they wanted to have Netflix instead of going to the movies, Netflix was just raking in this massive amount of content because they were willing to pay for it.
Netflix's wallet was fat. In 2006, the year prior to launching its streaming service, Netflix had a reported 6.15 million subscribers. By the end of 2010, that number nearly tripled to 18.26 million subscribers. So the company had the cash to go on a buying spree. They struck up a deal with Starz, gaining the digital rights to about 1,000 movies. They inked deals with Warner Brothers and the Walt Disney Company. But Hollywood industry insiders began to see a problem brewing.
It's about the content.
That's the former CEO of the Walt Disney Company, Michael Eisner, talking to Reed Hastings at the 2010 Churchill Club Conference. Eisner saw a growing problem for Netflix. The Hollywood veteran viewed content as king. Whoever created original movies and TV shows had the advantage.
But in the streaming world, you have to have the rights. So to compete with cable pay television, subscription pay television, somebody in the streaming world is going to step up and get those rights. And then eventually, those rights are going to be less important, and the distribution company that is in that business will start making its own original product, Sopranos, whatever. Because library footage is only going to get you so far, in my opinion. So you're going to have current films, current television shows, or make your own. Because they're having trouble now, the studios, selling the way they used to sell their films to HBO, because HBO discovered that original product actually is more exciting to their customers than non-exclusive retreads.
Reed Hastings probed the Hollywood veteran on this topic.
And would your advice be that we're better paying a lot for the movies against those firms or to invest in scripted original content like HBO did?
Depends who you are. If you're Rupert Murdoch and you're willing to bet the company, as he has often, you go in to whichever company is on their knees and you make an offer they can't turn down. Because that will be cheaper for you in the short term than trying to create your own product in enough volume to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Or you could shortcut that whole thing and say, I am going to make a continuing flow of original content, not movies, not Avatar, but Sopranos, Sex and the City, Mad Men, whatever it is. But I'm going to tell my customers, if they want original product, they get it here first. But if you don't do one of the two of those things, somebody else will. Okay, so what's your strategy?
Our preferred strategy is to carry those companies' product. So we distribute Starz today. We distribute a number of Showtime shows, but not current season. But our view is we should write them large checks and carry the content. However, at the end of the day, they may decide that they're not willing to do that. And so it's not clear that, you know, what the success strategy of that will be either. So our primary strategy, like we do with Starz, is to carry the content and then write them big checks.
Michael Eisner was intrigued by Reed Hastings' comment and felt the path forward for Netflix was clear.
Now you're convincing me that the solution is original, semi, or exclusive product that only you have. Because if I can get everything you describe everywhere, other than you being faster and quicker technologically, what do you have to offer to me that some other guy in another company figures out a better way to do? You've created a recommendation tool.
Yep.
So you've built a better mousetrap. But what happens when the guy next door takes advantage of the fact that you're all on vacation, this unlimited vacation, and gets the same or better mousetrap? Is there not a point in time that you must consider originality and exclusivity? Or does that never come in this world of infinite opportunity?
It's something we think about a lot.
It was clear that Netflix was at a crossroads, and its CEO wasn't sure which direction to go. Netflix was either going to be solely a distributor of other people's films, or it would have to start creating its own original content as well. The path forward wasn't obvious, but the company was about to receive some signs that would help it make a decision.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Today, we're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. When I first heard about it, I thought, it's about time. This makes sense. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in for savings. Let's say you, your spouse, or kids see the doctor or other medical provider. When your claims come in, HealthLock automatically reviews them and flags any errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud, so you pay only what you owe. This is your money you're saving. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped members save more than $130 million. I get it, medical billing errors can happen, but you should be able to pay with confidence. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden medical bill errors. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's healthlock.com. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So by 2010, Netflix had reached a crossroads. Should the company continue to be just a distributor of other people's TV shows and movies, or should it take the plunge into creating its own original content? Both were pricey endeavors. Staying the course as a distributor, Netflix was going to have to pay big bucks for films that studios could cut them off from at any time. Or Netflix could go another route. It could begin making their own original content, but to do that would cost a pretty penny as well. In order to make Netflix at all tantalizing to subscribers, they'd need to make a lot of original content. And then there was the very difficult decision of what they should make. And this is where we get to the core of how Netflix beat Hollywood. You see, Netflix had been building something that no studio possessed. By creating and fine-tuning their recommendation algorithm for almost 15 years, Netflix understood the wants and desires of their subscribers in a way the studios could only dream of knowing. So Netflix had an advantage on selecting what original content to produce. If Netflix's path forward wasn't already clear, a series of reports would make the decision obvious.
Video rental chain Blockbuster has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection.
In September 2010, Netflix finally defeated Blockbuster.
Blockbuster has been synonymous with the home video market, but it's been losing money and market share for years. Competition from the likes of Netflix weighed on the retailer, dependent on its brick-and-mortar infrastructure.
Netflix won the DVD rental war, but their original service as a distributor of other people's content was about to become a risky business.
You can't Google Netflix at the moment without seeing the naysayers and doomsayers telling me that the loss of the Starz contract on content is going to be your Achilles heel, and you may as well switch the lights off.
In September 2011, Starz ended their deal with Netflix. The streaming service was going to lose an enormous amount of content. Reed Hastings attempted to downplay the development.
The Starz deal's only in the United States, and it's less than 10% of our content. So, you know, it is something, but it's not a huge deal. And we're actively working to replace that content by next March when the Starz content goes off.
It was clear, even to laymen in the media, that Netflix was in trouble if they had to continue to rely purely on Hollywood for content.
Who has the whip hand in all of this? Is it the content providers who have the material that you so badly want and demand, or is it yourselves as the distributors? I can't decide who actually is in the driving seat here.
Well, I'd say the content owners are really in the driving seat. We put forth offers to license that content for millions of dollars per year, and then it's up to them if they have a better offer or want to accept our offer. So mostly it's us making offers to them.
Reed Hastings could no doubt see his back was against the wall. Hollywood could cut Netflix off in a moment's notice. It was time to consider taking the plunge. Again, Reed Hastings.
Cable networks from all time have started on other people's content and then grown into doing their own originals. So we knew of the general idea for quite a while. And we had actually tried to get into original content back in 2005 when we were on DVD only and buying films at Sundance, Maggie Gyllenhaal's Sherry Baby, and we published on DVD. We were a mini studio, and it didn't work out because we were subscale.
Meaning they weren't big enough yet to make independent film projects profitable. But by 2011, the company had grown astronomically at the same time that Hollywood flirted with holding its content. Netflix was seriously considering taking the plunge into original content, but it wasn't until an off-the-hand comment in a meeting that started the company down the treacherous path.
So we were meeting at Netflix with a company called MRC, who mostly make independent films, large-scale independent films, and sell to the studios.
That's Ted Sarandos. In 2011, Sarandos was the head of Netflix content.
And at the end of the meeting, they said, by the way, we are taking out our first TV show. And we bought the rights to this British TV show called House of Cards, which I knew very well. I loved the show from watching it on DVD. And David Fincher is directing the pilot and exec producing.
Actors Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright were signed on to star. And three great scripts were apparently already written by an Oscar-nominated screenwriter.
We're not in the business of original programming at all. And I said, we'd love to look at it. And we started talking about it. And I said, you know, if what we are all building here is true, and that all TV networks and channels would become dot-coms, that ABC eventually would become an app. And we talked about this very confidently for many years. If all that's true, then what are the chances that any of these networks are going to sell us their programming? They're going to need it for themselves. So if that's the case, then we better get good at doing this ourselves.
But this House of Cards project was a hot commodity in Hollywood.
Everybody wanted it. I know HBO wanted it. I know FX wanted it. And there was no reason to sell it to Netflix. We've never launched an original anything. And the idea that we were going to transform the business on it, that we would know how to market it, that we'd know how to launch it, those are all, you know, not a given.
So Ted Sarandos immediately started digging into the Netflix data. He looked into how many Netflix subscribers watched movies featuring Kevin Spacey, whether those subscribers watched other movies he was in, and what types of roles drew him the largest audience on their platform. The data that Netflix had been gathering from its subscribers showed that viewers would likely watch a show with Spacey in a serious role, and those were the same subscribers that also liked political dramas. The algorithm was telling Ted Sarandos that House of Cards could be a hit.
So we said, look, let's go for this. And at the time they were inviting everyone to come to Sony, where David was working on a film, and they were going to do the pitch to everybody at Sony on Saturday. And I said, we don't want to come on Saturday. I'm telling you yes right now, and I want to come on Monday and meet David and tell him why he should do it with us.
Sarandos wanted to make director David Fincher an offer he couldn't refuse.
And I walked in the room and I said, there's 1,000 reasons not to do this at Netflix. I want to give you one reason to say yes, which is I'm going to give you 2 seasons with no pilot. And you have absolute creative freedom. And the only thing we ask is that you have to put your name on it.
Again, Reed Hastings.
Ted Sarandos, my partner at Netflix who runs content, got very excited about House of Cards. And at that time, it was $100 million.
David Fincher took the deal.
It was a fantastic investment, and it was in competition with HBO, and that was really the breakthrough that he picked right up front.
Again, Gina Keating.
Back in 2012, when they were trying to make House of Cards, it seemed sort of embarrassing, you know, that Netflix would be your studio, but they really had to overcome that part of it because people weren't sure, how are these people going to treat me? But it was a great deal at first. And again, they did a great job by saying, you know, do whatever you want. Here's $100 million. All we want is for you to deliver what you say you're going to deliver. Because they'd already done all the research on the front end. They had said, you know, we have this nexus with House of Cards people and Kevin Spacey people and people, you know, who love British thrillers and stuff like that. So they had already amassed an audience so they could kind of give the creatives their way, their head, and they could do what they wanted. And then they developed this fabulous reputation for paying a lot of money and then just stepping out of the picture.
And the approach was a smashing success.
And the Golden Globe goes to Kevin Spacey, House of Cards.
And the WGA Award goes to the writers of House of Cards.
As the years progressed, Netflix appeared to have the Midas touch.
The Emmy for Lead Actress in a Drama Series goes to
Claire Foy, The Crown.
Orange is the New Black!
Stranger Things.
I want to thank Netflix.
Thank you to Netflix.
We would like to thank everyone at Netflix, Ted Sarandos.
We'd like to thank Netflix.
Netflix would create one hit show after another. The Crown, Orange is the New Black, Stranger Things, Narcos. Again, Reed Hastings.
What we've done is invest a lot on the algorithms so that we feature the right content to the right people and try to make it fun and easy to explore.
They were also changing the nature of the business. Before Netflix, screenwriters and producers were relied upon to help pick the types of shows to produce, the category and themes, which actors were in demand. But their expertise was largely becoming obsolete for a Netflix production. Their algorithm helped them put those pieces together.
Everyone would rate Schindler's List 5 stars, and then they'd rate Adam Sandler, you know, The Do-Over, 3 stars. Okay, but in fact, when you looked at what they watched, it was almost always Adam Sandler.
By looking at the data captured by their algorithm, Netflix could see that their subscribers watched 500 million hours of Adam Sandler movies. So they cut a deal with the actor, 4 movies for $250 million. Before that deal was even finished, Netflix extended the deal for another 4 movies at the same price tag. And that strategy was paying off.
4.3 million. That's the number of new subscribers Netflix added last quarter, beating estimates and setting Netflix shares soaring today.
By 2018, Netflix's production budget ballooned. Again, Reed Hastings.
It's about $8 billion around the world. And it's not enough. There are so many great shows on other networks, and so we have a long way to go.
In just 20 years, Netflix went from a floundering DVD rental by mail business to surpassing the Walt Disney Company's production budget.
A few years ago, it seemed absolutely preposterous that this former DVD mail rental company would actually start creating content, and yet Netflix did a terrific job with it. Their hit ratio is astonishing. It's the envy of any Hollywood studio.
It was an astonishing, almost unbelievable feat. By 2020, Netflix had tallied over 200 million subscribers, all by using their algorithm to mine their audience's likes and desires. But their content began to take a noticeably woke detour. From their first endeavor into original content, Netflix appeared to make an attempt at being even-handed. But as the years passed, the company began to display a liberal bias.
Netflix is taking a stand against Georgia's so-called heartbeat law.
They signed a production deal with Barack and Michelle Obama, and Netflix began to air shows that no one appeared to be asking for.
Dear white people, I get that being reduced to a race-based generalization is a new and devastating experience for some of you.
This morning, Netflix is under growing fire after its release of the award-winning French film, Cuties.
It is beyond repulsive. It is actual softcore child porn.
Elon Musk, he said, the woke mind virus is making Netflix unwatchable.
What happened? How did Netflix go from their algorithm having the Midas touch to instead touching a cultural nerve? The answer is surprising. Netflix's algorithm appeared to come up against an even more powerful algorithm, crafted by a social architect looking to manipulate American culture.
Coming up on Red Pilled America.
Well, BlackRock has been the leader, and in some ways the ringleader, of all of Wall Street in pushing something called ESG investing. But really, what ESG is an excuse for Wall Street to push politics into corporate America. They can push in their own environmental policies, they can push in social and governance policies that could never be achieved at the ballot box.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Now you can get access to our entire back catalog of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast by becoming a Backstage subscriber. To subscribe, just visit redpilledamerica.com and click Join in the top menu. Thanks for listening.
Viking. Committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Today, we're all looking for ways to save. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in, then flags any hidden errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see any other healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.